just because Alaska is still a colony doesn't mean that your career choices are limited to working for whoever is the latest extractor, at least not entirely. Today we talk to a woman who chose hard labor for her livelihood and has the education to tell us why. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. Telephone number 1-800-478-8255-478-TALK. Email talk at alaskapublic.org. You're about to meet a female trail dog on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska, and by the Alaska Budget Report, providing in-depth coverage of state government since 1991, on the web at akbudgetreport.com. Start a meaningful career with a bachelor's degree in elementary or special education from home or on campus from the University of Alaska Southeast. Information at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Well, I had the great benefit of growing up in on the Allegheny Plateau in an area which had been totally logged over at the turn of the century, and as a result had come back in a great old-growth forest, and all the timber companies had gone out of business, and no other business had started up, so it was all woods, it was all state forests all around me. And I thought the whole world was made of that when I was a kid. I was comfortable in the woods, and I loved the woods. And my Uncle Bill loved them too, but he went out west and discovered that there you could have trails in the woods, not just places where you, little paths and so forth, game trails and whatnot, but you could actually have a trail that would... He went to all these national parks, and he had these amazing trails. And so he became the godfather. My Uncle Bill and my dad were among the first people to start promoting this 80-odd-mile trail there in the mountains of Pennsylvania, the Susquehannock Trail. And they formed a club, and the club got together, and they built the trail. They were the trail dogs of the... of northern Pennsylvania. And now this trail has grown into a whole network all over the state and on up into New York State. And I remember my Uncle Bill told me, he said, you know, we have this trail all along the top of the Appalachian Mountains. And you can walk from one end to the other. It's 2,000 miles long. And so and it got to a certain age, 1977, I started walking the Appalachian Trail. And I have 400 miles left to go, and I actually get to meet and interview on the radio a trail dog, somebody that actually makes these trails. Christine Bile, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Thank you, Steve. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, I have to tell you, Christine, that the Park Service trails are not well regarded by us as hikers because they're overly built. They don't have much of a grade. They tend to I don't know, it's like the Park Service has rules or something on this.
They do have a few rules.
I thought they might.
I encountered a few of those over 12 or so years working for the Park Service. And, yeah, that's trails are development. That's something I've had to make peace with. There's plenty of places where we might be better off without one at all. And certainly there are good and bad trails. But like I say in the book at one point, I see them as access points for us to get into the woods, maybe the way you did as a kid when we're not necessarily always comfortable doing that on our own, or people come to an area they don't know. And so trails at their best, I think, provide that access back in.
Yeah, I'm real big on trails, obviously, you know.
Yeah.
So here you are, a person who I guess kind of started out, this was just your little... this is how I'm going to make my money,
you
know, and then you discover it becomes your vocation. And yet, so maybe you supported your writing habit with your dirt work. And then you realize you can actually combine them. I think this is very interesting. So you were a fiction writer, and for some reason you decided to do this nonfiction book, Dirt Work, an education in the Woods, which is this out now? Do we have this, or is
yes,
this pre-publication?
Yep, it's out. It was out in mid-April, and it's been out for a few weeks now, and having a life of its own that no longer has anything to do with me, which is kind of fun.
So yeah, and it starts out in Montana, and it ends in outside of Denali Park.
Mm-hmm.
And you're now still kind of a trail dog in the sense that you have your own trail business. In other words, you went into, if I was a broadcaster, it'd be consulting.
Yeah. Consulting, although I don't like consulting too much because it implies kind of a clean take on things. And we do a lot of bushwhacking, and we do consulting as well as training and field on the ground, field trainings, teaching crews how to build rock walls and bridge work and dirt work too. We do some digging and getting blisters still. So I don't know. Can consultants get blisters? I guess that's the weed out question.
In Alaska, they can.
Yeah, exactly.
In Alaska,
that's a good point.
We can.
Totally.
Yes, we can. This is Alaska. That's why we're here.
Exactly.
Well, so yeah, and what is so wonderful? What drew me to this book immediately, and is also the way that you wrote it. I mean, the reason that you started it, which is using the tools as an entree to stories, including the story of you as a trail dog, the story of you as a woman in a physical, I don't know if I want to call it a profession, let's call it a vocation.
That's a good word for it.
In which cussing is customary. Sexual innuendo is expected, and you're not going to change none of that. And you have to be a very hard physical laborer and hold your own.
Yes.
And that's something to write about.
That was quite an education, for sure. And to be entirely disclosing, many of the worst mouths and dirtiest jokes I've heard have been from women. So, the book... really is
except for you. You're ladylike.
Right, especially on the air.
Uh-huh. Well, that's good. We have rules about that.
I know. It's public radio. But the book is, it tells the story in a way of the subculture that I stumbled into right out of college, took a job on my first trail crew, really on a bit of a whim to, like you said, make a paycheck, take a break between college and what I thought was going to be grad school and philosophy. And I often say I got shanghaied by the woods, and I over the years became a trail dog, and this will be my 17th season in the field. And I did end up getting some graduate work in there in the middle, but I still primarily identify myself that way with this group of vocational woodsy folks who have a pretty cool set of skills and a community and a culture and a vocabulary that I thought at some point really lent itself to being told.
There's also the matter of being in shape and withstanding the physical insults and challenges of it all.
Yeah, that's a big part of it. There's a quote. It's a Nietzsche quote, and I'm not going to get it right exactly, but it's something about the quickest way to fraternity and good feelings is through exhaustion. And that's definitely been an experience of mine, that coming into this subculture as a pretty green, not terribly experienced laborer, and often working with people that I didn't have a whole lot in common with, that sense of really pushing yourself to a limit, especially outdoors, did lend itself to a really deep camaraderie, as you have each other's back, you're watching out for each other's safety, you're feeding each other, you're living in the woods and sleeping on mats, you know, feet away from each other. It lends a really deep sense of intimacy that is one of the things that really drew me.
Okay, I'm going to go right to the money shot here, the main question that everybody wants to know, which is, what do you do when you got to pee? I know what men do.
I talk about that in the book. There's a little section about it, and I don't know if I'll be able to find it off the top.
Oh, that would be great. If you could
head,
read that would be...
Yeah, I will. Let me see. Where is it? It's one of those delicate things because... Actually, my first cruise in Glacier that I was on, there were a lot of women. It was a really neat thing to stumble into this life.
When you say cruise, tell me what that is.
Well, in Glacier we have.
What's that cruise in a hitch?
Yeah, I hear. There I go dropping into the specialized language. So my first season in Glacier, there were about 30 trail workers on the west side of the park, And, excuse me, this is my cold.
It's all right. It's going around. Everybody in the States got it.
Yeah. I was hoping it would be gone by now. But so there were a lot of female crew leaders, and that was a really... Gosh, I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. Don't worry about it. Don't over-medicate, whatever you do.
Let me look for the section real quick.
Okay. Well, then, I'll just carry on. We're talking with Christine Bile. She's the author of Dirt Work, An Education in the Woods. She's a product of the MFA Creative Writing Program at the University of Alaska Anchorage. And she's friends with Eva Salidas, who was our... who was our guest a few weeks ago at a really nice show, a lady who is in the science world and came into the writing in the memoir world, and shared with her, you know, I asked her to come in and be prepared for a bunch of readings, and we had such a conversation, we never got to the readings part. So now I asked Christine for readings.
Oh, we might never get to it either.
I'm kind of wishing I hadn't.
No, I'm sorry. I've been doing fine.
Not to worry. Not to worry. Well, the the trails in the Denali area are kind of different from trails here in trails in the lower 48. And I think generally in Alaska, wouldn't you say that the trail situation is...
Oh, it's a whole different world up here. I'm telling you, discontinuous permafrost is not ideal for trail building.
Well, I am thinking that there has to be like lots of rock work when you're...
Actually, I did a lot more rock work in Montana.
Really?
Yeah, there are a lot of alpine...
With
these trails, with
scree and so forth, and you use rocks to like stabilize and whatnot, get your drainage wherever.
Argillite is a common rock in Montana. Yeah. That's really good plains for building. We do some rock work for sure. Denali State Park crews do quite a bit of rock work. Uh-huh. We actually consulted with a crew down there a couple summers ago where they were getting to do some really cool stuff. But
well, I'll tell you what. Instead of looking for it.
I'm just trying to buy myself some time to get my throat back under control. I'm really sorry about this.
Well, I'll tell you what. We'll take a little break, okay?
Okay.
Is that all right?
Sure.
We could do the break that we normally do at quarter of and do it at quarter after instead. Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from... ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Every day, people all over Alaska are discovering that public transportation can benefit their businesses and their communities. Public transportation in Alaska provides 7 million rides a year to work, medical appointments, shopping, school, and social opportunities. There's more information at alaskamobility.org. This message sponsored by the nonprofit organizations Alaska Mobility Coalition and the American Public Transportation Association.
Of Alaska. We're talking about An Education in the Woods. Our guest is Christine Bile. She's author of Dirt Work, An Education in the Woods. She lives north of Denali National Park in the Stampede Road area, and she cut trails and, down around Cordova in the National Forest, Chugach National Forest, all over Prince William Sound, and in Denali Park, and now she's got a trail building and consulting business. She still gets her hands dirty with all this, and it's been 17 years. And so she has written this book about kind of the subculture of people who do this sort of work, who just don't ever get written up, really. And so I asked her, I said, so where do you pee? And she said, I found, She got all choked up about it. She got all choked up about it. And then she started looking for something in her book, and she, I think she found it now. Right?
I did.
You got it, Christine?
Goodbye, Glacier Matriarchy. I was the lone woman field leader in Denali. All told, women made up barely a quarter of the total hire. So on a crew with four guys, I had to set one ground rule early. I would not hike way off in the brush to take a leak. The boys turned their backs 10 feet away from me and watered the weeds, and I would do the same. My crouch was at least that modest. The pants dropped swift, held up around thighs, while t-shirt curtained bare butt pointed into the woods. If I rested my chin in hand while I sat, no one guessed I was peeing. If you have a problem with that, I told them, get over it. To their credit, they did. By mid-season, I could pee a few yards from any of them without a raised eyebrow. One guy came up to talk to me while I was crouched, and I gave him a full set of instructions. He realized his error only when I stood up and fiddled with my belt. Really, how would they dare complain? I am far subtler than they are, grown men the same as little boys. Their urine loud on the leaves from up high, that little shake they do when they finish. They know I've got them there. So you can see that question occurred to me, too, that I have to deal with in the book.
That was worth reading. Our telephone number is 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. Perhaps you have a question for a woman who works in a crew with a bunch of men, but you know, also other women. You're not the only woman that does
No,
this.
I'm not. And I have often said that. I think the first year that I started really green and a little bit out of my element, if I hadn't been on a crew, on a large crew, 30 people with sub-crews of about 4 to 5 people apiece, my first crew leader was a woman who had been doing trails for probably 4 or 5 years at that point, and several other women who were really role models for me. And they, watching them, gave me a picture of what I could be. And I don't know that I can say I wouldn't have done it without them, but having them as role models and as something to emulate and seeing how well they did their jobs and how grounded in a place they seemed was really a big draw for me in helping me figure out that I could do that too.
Well, I think anyone who is into athletics, and I certainly learned it hiking, distance hiking, is that you have no idea what your real physical capabilities are. And
right.
And yeah, I would think of it as hold even more for women, because there's a whole lot of things culturally that are going to, you know, sort of discourage women from getting involved in anything that's physically challenging. But the fact of the matter is their bodies are pretty much the same. It can really, you know,
yeah.
Most physical tasks, and you know, they're discovering this in the military too, is, you know, it's pretty much gender doesn't matter that much. The variability within the gender is vastly more.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And one of the big skills you needed, especially in Glacier, where I first started, where there's over 700 miles of trails in that hiking system, is you need to be able to hike long and fast and far, and I could do that. And that's one of those tasks that men and women can perform really similarly at. And then when you add in tools, you add a rock bar, I can move boulders that are a lot bigger than I can move on my own. And so those tools start simplifying or start kind of flattening out the differences as well. I write about gender quite a bit in the book and about bodies. Here's a little section.
Thanks.
That summer, I showed off my arms for anyone. This is my first summer as I was watching myself get stronger. I parodied the strongman's pose, inviting irony to take the edge off my pride. But in a tank top at a bar, I flexed when asked, let total strangers squeeze my biceps. I've never been drawn to the passively feminine wiles, and in my new arms, I felt the intoxication of latent power, the knowledge that I didn't just look a certain way, but could force something to happen, that I could take the world into my own hands. Women have long been told that our bodies are to be presented, arranged for viewing, and that our power comes through flirting, a psychological dominance that stands in for physical strength. Goodbye to all that, which had never suited me. I felt power in my body, by itself. So that was definitely a learning, a growing into myself component of that work, where I really did figure out, like, wow, this is, my body is a tool and it's a home and I can trust it to do stuff that I'm asking it to, which was, I mean, I started out as the stereotypical 90-pound weakling, and I'm still not going to scare anybody in a dark alley, but I that was a huge part of that first year. And
you still got your biceps, though.
Yeah, consulting isn't quite as as a consistent, but yeah, there was a, I think getting into that world in my early 20s kind of set an expectation for me for a life that I could ask and require of my body that it really be a participant in whatever I do.
So how did your parents take this eternal, what people usually do for one season or two, you ended up doing for a career?
Well, there was a period where there might have been a little bit of the, like, when are you going to go back to grad school again feeling.
Which you did.
I did eventually, yeah. It was about 8 years between when I left college and when I returned for my MFA in creative writing, which was pretty different. My first intention was to be an academic. I would have guessed it if you'd asked me at 20. Oh, I don't know what we ever know about ourselves really at 20, but I would have said I was going to be a philosophy prof at a university. So that took a little bit of getting used to, I think. But the other side of that is, you know, my dad is a field laborer. He's a land surveyor, and he owned his own business from a pretty early age.
Well, that's right. It comes up in the book. You actually went out with him a few times.
Yeah, and I, you know, held the dumb end of the measuring stick and looked through the theodolite and had flagging and plumb bobs and all that in my background. My dad's dirty boots and work shirts were a really huge part of the sensory experience of my childhood. And you know, I grew up camping and playing in the sand dunes on the Great Lakes. And so there was a deep respect and culture in my family of being out and what that could mean and that could be a job as well. So I think once, for both myself and my larger family, once we kind of got over the fact that, okay, maybe I wasn't going to go the track I thought I was, there's a lot of love for that choice from both of my folks and all my family. I mean, I wouldn't be where I am, both as a writer and as a laborer, I think, without those early roots.
There's something about the accomplishment, the undeniability of the physical accomplishment that is pretty fine. You know, you get some miles done and you know that it's going to drain right. And you know that whoever the old lady is going to be able to actually make her way up that.
Yes, that's incredibly satisfying. Knowing, I think for me too, because I had come out of a background the first 18 or 19 years of my life, I had done mostly jobs that had pretty intangible results. I worked in a bookstore. I was a clerk for a lawyer. I had done more kind of jobs that you do with your head. So. Building something, getting somewhere on your feet and building something you could see and touch and watch people hike down weeks later is really an amazing feeling.
Have you dug up another reading on that?
I have a little piece here. It's so funny. This is how writers are. I always think I said it best in the book.
Well, I think there's something to be said for that. But also, yeah, the skill of being able to put your finger on it. You've gotten much better on that in the last 10 minutes.
Thanks.
Yeah.
So this is from the end of my first hitch, which you asked me earlier about a hitch, and I coughed my way out of it. But a hitch is, we refer to as a chunk of time that you spend in the backcountry. So in Glacier, those were typically 8 to 10 day hitches. We'd go out, we'd get packed in by mule strings, and then we'd live in one place in the backcountry for 8 to 10 days and do, you know, 2 weeks, 80 hours worth of labor. So my first hitch I spent out with my crew leader, Reba, who is a piece of work who I learned so much from. And I had a really trial by fire as we built Turnpike, which is the kind of raised section of trail that where you use gravel and logs to build a box that lifts it up out of muddy spots. So at the end of that, I looked, this is the paragraph from the end. I've probably built miles of Turnpike since that first. By watching closely and asking questions, I learned what to do, and in time could tell someone else how to do it. The parts I love best are choosing a tree for stringers and dropping it from sky to ground, the first 20 minutes of peeling off bark and marking and notching the joints. Still, my proudest turnpike is that first one, when invisible and naive, I devoted myself to the least skilled, most backbreaking laborer, hauling buckets of gravel, and at the end of the week, staring down that length of corridor, I could not name a better thing I'd ever done.
Well, if you're ready, we'll start talking about tools, and that'll get all the Alaskans calling. I think probably one to bring up right away would be the chainsaw.
Yeah, that's a common Alaskan accoutrement for sure.
I was I had a steel chainsaw, and it was kind of that smaller one, not the little one, but the smaller one that they made specifically for people to go in the woods and get firewood. And what I discovered is, it's damn hard to start that thing. Which it has this choke thing on it, and you need to know when to choke and unchoke and not to flood it. But it's damn hard to start a steel chainsaw.
Yeah. Actually, it's I hate to keep doing this, but I have this this little paragraph here. There's an argument in woodswork: Husqvarna versus Steel, the two most highly regarded professional saws. Like Ford versus Chevy, the defenders and detractors of each are as strident as politicos or sports fans. Really, they're both good saws, and it mostly comes down to what you're familiar with. If your dad drove a Chevy, chances are you will too. I learned to cut on a Steel, so it's my default. Steelheads say proudly, all these years and she's still running. But older Steels without a decompression button are notoriously hard to start. And if a Husky fan comes upon you reefing on the pull cord, he'll scoff. Still yarding on that thing, huh? So yeah, there's some sections in the book where I'm learning how to start a chainsaw, and I mean they're torturous to look back on and imagine what my poor crew leader must have thought. Like, how is this kid ever going to follow me around and be useful at all if she can't even start one in a parking lot?
Our telephone number 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422, email talk@alaskapublic.org. Christine Bile, author of Dirt Work and Education in the Woods, is our guest on Talk of Alaska. And Roger joins the program from White Mountain. Roger, welcome back to Talk of Alaska.
Yeah, good morning. I have a question. Our woods in our region, northwest Alaska, stretch from Unalakleet to Council, which is a little over 200 miles. The trails you were talking about, are they footpaths? If so, how do you deal with four-wheeler traffic, which really beats up the trail over time? I'll hang up and listen to your response. Thank you.
All right. Yeah, thank you. Of course, in the national park, you're probably not going to have to deal with that.
Right. Although Denali is interesting that way, the preserve section of the park is, there are a lot of ATV, off-highway vehicle use sections where subsistence activities are still protected. And so even within the park, we do quite a bit of at least assessment and damage control for overused areas. And I've never been up in that part of western Alaska, and I always hesitate to do major trail prescription in areas I haven't seen, because such a big part of trail work is reading terrain, making decisions based on-the-ground reconnaissance about how certain ground or topography is going to hold up the best. But in general, those areas where we have... With trails, we're always looking for a way to have a durable tread surface, which is something we can walk or ride on over time that won't degrade. And that's the catch-22, because the more we use it, the more erosion and the manual wearing away of the trail we cause. So in areas that I'm picturing that are probably pretty boggy, tend to have highly saturated soils, especially around breakup and periods of high rain, often you end up needing to go with some kind of tread augmentation. A lot of communities I've seen use things like GeoGrid, geotextiles, where there's a hardened trail surface that allows plants to grow up through it. A lot of times you can do that with imported gravel and fill. And a lot of times those aren't cost effective. And when they're in very far out areas, you don't have that trail hardening, and you end up with a lot of braiding, which you can see from the air in highly sensitive areas. It's pretty depressing. And as a rider, when you're trying to get somewhere, it can be, a pretty big deterrent. So that's always the thing for us when we're doing trail prescription and assessment, is to walk the terrain and to see, is there any way this could be in a better place? Are there soils nearby, whether it's on an esker or an edge of a bluff or something, where we might get better drainage? And then a lot of times in Alaska, you just plain don't have those topographical variations because you're in wetlands or boggy areas. And then you just kind of do the best you can with the hardening and the traffic, sometimes closing a trail for a period if that's feasible right around breakup. Right now, actually, our trails are at their most tender, sensitive, because a lot of times there's frozen ground beneath, and so water isn't percolating. I mean, up in Denali, still, we have a foot of snow on our property, so we're not even to breakup yet.
Yeah.
But that's a great question.
You know, in Vermont, the oldest part of the Appalachian Trail is just north of New York City in Harriman State Park. But Vermont actually had this earlier trail called the Long Trail that was established before the Appalachian Trail. And for many years, horses were allowed on it. It's never really recovered from that.
Oh, yeah. Horses are incredible. We used
it's
to...
It's like sometimes there's a groove like 6 feet deep.
Oh, yeah. That was a problem we ran into a lot in Glacier because, as I mentioned earlier, our hitches were all supported by stock. So, yeah, there was a lot of stock traffic, and we used to joke that that horses should be called four shovels and a stomach, because basically all they did was eat when they got there, and on the way there, it was like digging four holes as they walked because they're, you know, that all that weight being borne onto those four little hooves, it can cause a lot of damage.
Yeah. Yeah, some trails have put up with that, with it really rocky and so forth, and some not so much.
Mm-hmm.
Seems to me, in the muddy ones in particular, not so much.
Yeah, it's a lot. It's really different having a pack string like down in the western Montana area in the Rockies and Bob Marshall and so on, where stock traffic really was the developing use for a lot of those trails, people getting out on horseback, whereas in western Alaska and in the part of the interior where I'm from, that wet, saturated soil is not as ideal for horse traffic.
You'll appreciate this because I know you've experienced it, but there are places in Vermont where the trail will come into wilderness and go back out of wilderness maybe 3 miles. And in the wilderness, the trail maintenance has to be done without power tools.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So you get all this axe work and stuff.
Yep. Yeah.
You know, an actual real cross-cut saw.
Yes. Yeah, that we ran into that quite a bit in Glacier, again, because there were some areas where there were power saw closures, whether it was for a time of year or during fire season. If it was really intense burn capabilities, we would, you know, you wouldn't want to run a saw because of the potential for sparks. So we used cross-cuts every so often, but the Bob Marshall, the wilderness area to the south, they use crosscut solely. And man, a crosscut is a beautiful skill to cultivate and to watch and learn. And I'm a much better power sawer than I am a crosscutter, but I do like to get it out. We have an old one that was in my husband's family for over 100 years, and we occasionally use it on our lot just for the fun of keeping that tool, traditional tool use, alive.
Well, I've also found out that you kind of have to know your tree and, you know, where the weight, where the mass is in the tree.
Mm-hmm.
And then hopefully no wind. But you can be pretty efficient, even with an axe,
mm-hmm.
You know, if you know what you're doing.
Yeah.
There's a lot of knowing what you're doing involved, though.
Yes. Felling trees definitely goes better if you know what you're doing. But I think sometimes people think, oh, maybe a crosscut would be more dangerous. But because you move so slowly and deliberately, actually making, if you put in a face cut on a larger size tree and then making your back cut with a cross cut, you really, where the power saw, you're putting in that back cut pretty quickly and you're pulling out right as your cut or your
and
face
you're hoping
cut
you're
starts
running
to
the right
close.
Direction.
Right. Whereas with a cross cut, you're like right there where you can feel the fibers popping really slowly and you can pull out the saw and use a wedge to bring it over. And it's really you kind of slow the whole process down in a way that's really cool.
Oh, I'm having too much fun. I just love this kind of talk. As Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. The School of Management at the University of Alaska Southeast is open for business and welcomes students from across Alaska. Online degree programs and courses prepare students for professional careers or can be applied to your current career. Explore the options online at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by University of Alaska Southeast.
It's Talk of Alaska, and our guest is Christine Bile, author of Dirt Work, An Education in the Woods. She's a trail dog. We were just talking about crosscut saws, and we got a chainsaw question on the phone and an email inquiry from Cottage Grove, Oregon. Leigh says, I just finished the book, and I love it. I would love to hear her description of lynx directly from the author's mouth. And she says, ask Christine to read it from page 213 and 14. Pretty precise.
That's great. I don't have to rifle through my pages. Actually, that's really cool to be asked that because I love this particular section
aloud. It's a great one. I like that one. I'm a cat owner, so.
Lynx. Listen. Lynx. A feline. A cat. A verb. This lynx that. A word without vowels and an X to boot. Lynx whose population spikes so closely mirror snowshoe hares that you can't think cat without thinking rabbit. Lynx travels fastest at night, hunts on the ground, but can climb trees and swim. On my road a few miles down from the cabin, in the park, asleep midday, skulking the ditch line after dark, lynx. The L rolls out shy, almost hidden in the tongue's crevice, the crick of the middle ink as if poised for a leap, an X's secretive hiss falling on tufted ears, such bony structure visible beneath the skin of animals and words. Thank you, Oregon.
Well, you know, you probably could, you might go back to that philosophy, as it turns out.
Well, that's one of the things that I'm really interested in probing in the book, is that dichotomy that culturally we have been given, that the life of the mind and the life of the body are really separate, and we should strive for one over the other, depending on what our path is. But
that's only the Western culture. That's only the Western culture.
It is. Yeah. It's very, very true. And there, my woods work really was the catalyst for me to grow into a more nuanced realization that our bodies and our minds are pretty inextricably connected, and that a lot of people that I've worked with out on the trail who are autodidact, self-taught, not educated in the classical sense, who are really some of the wisest and brightest people that I've ever known. And so continuing to plumb that on a lot of levels in the book, how can we think and do with the same set of hands and minds?
When I got out, my education, my higher education is in art. And but my what I did my reading on was philosophy. I can talk philosophy.
Oh, so great. get
epistemology especially. I can really talk it. But after my first year of art school, there weren't student loans back in 1961. There was no such thing. I had to go get a job, which turned out to be at the radio station, which was handy. But I had to get a job, and the first job my dad got for me through political connections, and it was going out to all these vast state forests we have, because Smokey the Bear had said that they might burn down, so we had to cut the brush back from these miles and miles and miles and miles and miles, endless miles of forest roads. And they would have these crews of people to do that. So I went out. That's the only work of that sort I've ever had. And it turned out I absolutely loved it. And then, of course, the money runs out. I mean, in a few weeks, there's no money, and the crew is disbanded and everything. But it was a different culture than I thought it was going to be entirely. I mean, here I am, this educated guy, knows about philosophy and mm-hmm. all that. And we didn't talk too much about that, although every once in a while it would pop up here and there. But even the most inane kind of sayings and things like that can get more meaning when they're tied to something you're having to do with your hands. I'm not talking about work songs necessarily, but there are phrases that will gain if they're repeated 90 or 100 times.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
They're burnished.
Yeah, that's...
It's in the ethnography. It is in the folk life.
Yeah, that's true. I'm having trouble coming up with one off the top of my head, although I'll think of one later.
Oh, are you kidding? They're burned into you. They're engraved into you, and you never get over them.
Yeah, and that's a big connector for me of the mind and the body work is language and the way you become at home, both in a subculture like the Trails one and also in a place, is learning what do you call things and what do people call you? What are the nicknames? What are the tool names? What differentiates a beginner from an advanced user? What would they call something? That language as a way to communicate internally and also as a way to describe yourself, that was a really big, deep education for me in language as well as in work.
And also in the folk life of things, you know, you have a person leave the crew and not be around. I mean, be gone for 2 years and you're still passing on their sayings.
Oh, man. Yeah, there's a...
Seriously.
Totally. There's a guy...
Just because it was something colorful about it, or because it said something about the person, or because it said something about a situation in life. that's been captured in the folk life.
Yeah, there are a bunch of sections in the book where I write about people who say stuff that, and half of them I don't think I can read on the air because
I know we have to be real careful.
Colorful.
I knew we were treading on a little swampy ground here, but
there is one guy. I've got this was a guy who was on Gabe's crew for a few years, and he
you're still using his things.
Yeah, he says many of Ira's greatest hits had military origins. He called Gabe my leader and followed him within 5 feet on the trail, stopping to pee when Gabe did, or waiting spine straight, eyes straight ahead for him to catch up. When Gabe told him, "Go past, I'll catch up," he'd holler, "I stick with you, man, you're my leader." Every night on hitches, Ira ate too much and moaned, "Man, that put the hurts on me." Another common mealtime phrase, "Gabe, I'm a freaking huge fan of your beans and rice." And we still say, I say that I'm a freaking huge fan of Gabe's cooking, like at least twice a week, and all of those things that just, he had many others too. That's what I like about man, you're always thinking. He'd say that like at least twice a day. And then if he screwed up, he'd shake his head and bellow, "I warned you guys, I'm as sharp as a marble." And this guy was a gem and a great laborer to have on the crew. He was super strong, but it's his vocabulary and language that I will remember forever. God bless Ira.
Oh, my leader's going to pee. I better pee too.
Yeah, Gabe wasn't used to that degree of fanatical
None of us
adherence.
Are interested. Even a little brother's not going to do that.
Yeah.
Let's go to Sean, joins the program from Juneau. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Sean, with Christine Bile.
Hello. Hey, thanks for putting me on the air.
Sure.
It's an interesting program. It's not too often that you hear somebody who's out there in the trenches, so to speak, you know, working with their hands. It's more of a cerebral kind of show, I think, most of the time.
Yeah.
Well, cool. We can be cerebral here if you want it.
We may get there.
I was just going to comment that it is interesting, though, when you are working with your hands and doing manual labor, how much time you actually have, you know, in your headspace to think about things. And I think there is a natural connection between maybe, you know, deep thought and especially repetitive labor, mindless, you might say, you know, although no labor is completely mindless. But I also wanted to thank you for the work that you do out there, because putting the improvements into the trails really makes them accessible to more people. And especially as the population gets older and people aren't as agile as they used to be, it really opens up areas, you know, for people who wouldn't normally get out into the trail and trail systems. And while some of the purists or the kind of the snooty hikers out there might frown at it, it really does keep down on the amount of damage that's done to the trails. It prevents them from being, you know, endlessly braided like you talk about, which destroys a lot more territory, especially in the wet habitat.
Thank you very much. It's nice to give a shout out to the many, many people in the state and in the lower 48 as well who are doing that really important work. And I mentioned earlier that trails, you know, if you're really honest with yourself, is development work of some kind, but it's also conservation work. And for me, it's that balance, you know, how do you develop something, provide infrastructure for people to use and access a place in a way that protects the larger resource. And like you mentioned, unherded human traffic can cause a lot of damage. So the best trails, hopefully, people don't notice or think a whole lot about who did what. You're able to just pass through without a lot of worry and spend time in the place that you're trying to connect with.
Hey, Sean, it says here you wanted to talk about chainsaws.
Yeah, just one last thing, and actually this comment is referred to, more specifically to you, talking about how hard it is to get those things started. But I was recently living in Haines, Alaska, and there was a fellow there who's since passed on by the name of Pete Lapham. Probably knows more about chainsaws than any other person I've ever met. He was a dealer for many years, a logger before that, lived with chainsaws, worked with them all of his adult life. And I came into his shop because he was selling them, and I was looking for, you know, a big saw, something that was, you know, impressive and manly. And what he did was he asked me what I needed to do and steered me towards literally the smallest saw in the shop. And he said, "You need to spend the extra money and get this feature called Easy Start. And it's a like a spring-loaded clutch in there where you make several small pulls on it, and then it kind of snaps over center, and it rotates, you know, several turns in a row. And it honestly makes it so easy to start that literally like a kid can do it." So here's a guy that's been working with chainsaws all his life, and when an innovation like this comes along and makes it easier to start, he didn't hesitate for a second before getting that. And that it really makes it so much easier to use those things. You might want to look into that, the next one that you buy.
Well,
I
you
might.
Know, it's funny you should say that. When I read those sections now about how hard it was for me to start, part of it was my negligible upper body strength and my timidity at the time. But also back then, the older saws that I first used didn't have a compression switch, which is another, or button, which is another feature on newer saws where you push that and it releases some of the pressure you're pulling against in the cylinders. And saws now are really quite easy to start, and it's really fun because I teach a lot of chainsaw classes. My husband and I run this business called Interior Trails, and last summer we taught a class to our local fire department, volunteer fire department, and I got a woman in her late 50s who hadn't run a saw much and her teenage daughter both starting a saw and ready to buck up wood by the end of the time, which is really fun and probably could not have happened with those old beasts that were so laborious. And incidentally, the model you're talking about, the small, still powerful, but model chainsaw, the guys on my first Glacier crew called that the Lady Logger. But obviously...
I'll tell you what, when you've got old school logger, chainsaw dealers, and that's the one that they're recommending to people, there's something to be said for modern technology. I think that capacitive discharge ignition in place of magnetos, and certainly that over-center spring setup they've got, it just literally a couple of light pulls, and then you make one more pull, and it just kind of snaps over with a few turns. It starts up every time. It's a miracle.
I can't tell you how delighted I am to have heard you say magneto on the air. That will be my favorite moment of the week.
We're talking some serious equipment geekery here.
Right.
Thank you, Sean. It's Talk of Alaska. We're talking about, it turns out we're talking about tools now. And I'm more than happy to talk about tools. I want to know about this bar, the rock bar.
Oh, the rock bar.
Yeah, first off, this is a heavy piece of steel that you're carrying into the woods.
Yeah.
I guess it's steel. Maybe it's iron. I don't know.
Yeah, it's tempered steel. It's a rock bar, sometimes called a pry bar.
And you're talking what? This thing has to weigh what? 15 pounds?
16 to 18 pounds, probably. Yeah, it's typically about 5 feet long. And, we use bars, metal bars of all kinds in Alaska.
I mean,
you have crow bars.
It's just 5 feet.
Yeah, and it has a beveled edge. Here's a little piece from the book. A rock bar works because of leverage. Slide the beveled end under a rock, the curve facing the ground. With fulcrum in place, push down slightly on the handle and the rock will lift, your effort magnified. If the curve faces the rock, not the ground, the fulcrum is misplaced and any advantage will slip away. As with all hand tools, the rock bar asks for wise use. A tool like a word can be used badly, its beauty rendered moot by carelessness. Physics ignored, the rock bar is just a heavy stick.
Yeah. So, yeah, I was just thinking about the actual use of it, and I was impressed by how much you could move with one of those.
Oh, man, the rock bar. I think one of the reasons the rock bar is...
You want to get gravity on your side.
Yeah, it's on my list of favorite tools because it enabled me, as really one of the smallest and weakest members of the crew, to actually approximate some level of strength because of the physics involved in, planning the move so that your gravity's on your side and flipping something as opposed to lifting it or rowing it off of a levered position. All of those things made it so that I could actually hope to move something that somebody else could just grab in their arms, like Ira, who I was talking about earlier. He could pick up a 200-pound rock without really even thinking about it. Well, of course, I could never do that, and that's why the rock bar soon became my favorite, one of my favorite tools.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's... I would think in trail building it would really count, size would really count when it comes to rocks.
Oh, yeah. My crew leader always used to say when doing rock work, if you can move it by yourself, it's not big enough. So you either needed a rock bar or a partner in order to think, especially for, the first course of a rock wall or like the capstone of a rock project where it was you can sometimes get away with slightly smaller stuff. But in general, rule of thumb, bigger is definitely better with rock work.
It seems to me a lot of the trails in the... that I'm acquainted with, and certainly a Chugach Forest, leave a bit to be desired.
Mm-hmm.
So often they're even hard to find. Mm-hmm. Now, I know part of this is budgetary, but it also seems to me they're just not very well done sometimes.
Well, Alaska is really interesting because really we're such a young state, and the recreational infrastructure up here is so much younger that we're still kind of in that period where a lot of our trails are really just inherited alignments from old personal use trails, social trails to access certain hunting grounds, dog mushing trails that have turned into summer use trails that aren't necessarily in the best terrain for that, social trails that were meant to get you to a cabin on a lake where you did your fishing or whatever, and now they're gradually being used by more and more users, and they haven't really been engineered in the way that a sustainably used trail would, to keep in mind things like tread durability and bench cut and outslope and drainage and all that stuff. So that's, we're kind of at that point in Alaska where the undesigned trails that we've inherited are now being used heavily by more than they were intended for originally when they were a personal use travel corridor. And so there's a kind of a catch-up period in there, which the lower 48 also went through more so probably in the 70s and 80s, where there was a lot of thought about how to bring those trails up to speed.
Yeah, there's a combination between landscape architecture and just good old-fashioned woodsmanship and civil engineering and the art of the possible.
Mm-hmm.
Which is like if you're hiking 8-9 miles in before you're even getting to start working on the trail, really counts. You gotta concentrate on the art of the possible.
Mm-hmm.
But you're digging around, let's go to another call. Bob on Prince of Wales Island, welcome to Talk of Alaska, Bob.
Well, thank you for taking my call and enjoying your program today.
Thank you.
I have one question for the lady.
Yes.
In a previous life of mine, I used to have to run crews, sometimes to be mixed male, female, sometimes pretty much male, sometimes just female. But given my choice, I would pick female crews every time. It seemed like I got more work out of them with the less bull roar to go along with it. Have you noticed anything about like that?
You know, I would be hesitant to say that I've never worked on an I've worked on small crews that are entirely female, not a whole program. But women, I think, we're in this field, in labor fields in general, we are always being watched to see if we're pulling our weight. And so women who want to get into a field like that are constantly operating at a level of, I've got to prove myself. And I think that might be some of it, is that it's kind of self-selecting in that women who are getting into the stuff have a real passion or desire to try it and push themselves, whereas it might be more of a default for men, and so they can kind of coast if that's in their nature. I mean, I've worked along, you know, the two hardest workers I can think of, one is male and one is female, and I've worked with lazy men and lazy women too, and you know, had my moments out there as well. But I think a blended crew can be really nice, because the deeper into a work project you get and the more invested in the product and the more you rely on each other, the more that gender BS falls away and you kind of just become people working together, not checking each other out, not trying to offend or weed out, not trying to impress or prove, just kind of dropping into a groove where the project and the end and the culture among you is the most important thing. And those for me have been some of the really beautiful moments about being out in the woods as a woman among men, is feeling that sense of the possible in a way that I hope I can take to other arenas as well, where we're not always thinking about whether we're outsiders or insiders or who's stronger or faster or better, but just that we've all got something to offer. And sometimes the crassest mouth or the strongest person might be a woman, and other times it's a man, and you kind of just deal with whoever you're with at the time and appreciate them for what they are.
All righty. Well, that's a little bit of insight. Thank you very much. Have a good day.
All right. Thank you, Bob. Yeah, you know, it seems to me what you're saying is you'd like to get to the point where you could relax and feel as free to goof off as the men.
There's a lot of goofing off that goes around. That's one of the great parts about, you know, just to augment the philosophical tone, a lot of the book, a lot of what I'm writing about in Dirt Work is just the funny stories and the oral tradition that I have been kind of a part of. Many of the stories in the book, anecdotes and such, I wasn't even there, but I've heard the stories retold and told so many times that mm-hmm. They're partly mine. And I think my point isn't to claim ownership over this life as much as to just bear witness to this subculture with all its quirks and to kind of say how it's impacted my path.
We're finally getting it down in print. I mean, somebody actually writing about it. We just don't get this.
Yeah.
We just don't get this. Okay, I got another piece of equipment I got to go into. It's the Bobcat.
Uh-huh.
It's the Bobcat.
Well, I have a
I understand that it's totally forbidden to ride in a bucket of a bobcat.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, some people forbid it. Usually crew leaders, higher ups. But everybody who's worked on a crew in the woods for very long has ridden in a bobcat bucket. Do we have time for a quick paragraph about the bobcat?
Okay.
This is a great one for Alaska. The best way to learn to run a machine is from a cocky guy who's lived in Alaska for 30-odd years, who's worked out west on the slope for the mine, up north on the ice, building the pipeline, the highway, on a fishing boat for the Union. Watch when he drives, where he flicks his wrist, not his arm, how he grips the throttle loose like a baseball bat in a pro's hand, not white-knuckled like yours. Listen to what he says. Grease the zerks. Did you check the plug? Split your tracks? Make a windrow? Feather it? If you don't know what he's talking about, listen longer. He'll say it again. Bite your tongue when he calls you honey, sugar, or sweet cakes. He's kidding, mostly. Don't be defensive when he says you're slow, the bucket isn't full enough, you forgot to throttle up before you lifted the arms, you're doing it all wrong. He's right. You are. Don't tell him when you accidentally put unleaded into the gas tank instead of diesel and bugger up the works. Take a deep breath, change out the fuel filter, bleed the lines. Believe it, someday you'll do it right. And then he'll tell you, way to go, honey.
Now that's a voice of experience.
Yeah,
That part about the fuel there.
Yeah. Yeah, you can tell, huh?
Well.
Won't do that again. That's one of the ways you learn is make a mistake. And that's how I've learned most of what I know is did it wrong the first time.
Clean up your own mess.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Did you manage to get away with it?
Yeah, it just went through the steps that I detailed.
Uh-huh. And that'll work? Need to know this, and people are listening right now.
Yeah, it was definitely a moment of panic when I realized what I had done. But that's why they make the gas jugs two different colors, obviously. But, you know, sometimes when you're in a hurry.
Yeah. What you're saying here is that, you know, for much of human culture, there wasn't any writing. There was maybe even rudimentary language. And how do people learn? They learn through emulation.
Mm-hmm.
Emulation is everywhere in folk life.
Yes.
And that's how you started. And if you had like 10 seconds, 15 seconds to give advice to somebody that wants to be a trail dog, what would it be?
Well, the advice that I would have given myself earlier was watch closely, be humble, be a sponge, pick up everything, and give yourself some slack while you're learning. It's a lot easier that way.
Yeah.
I was lucky to have some great mentors.
Right. Well, thank you so much for coming and being with us in the face of physical impediments there.
You're welcome, Steve. Thank you for having me. It was a real pleasure.
You hung in there.
Thanks.
Christine Bile is our guest. Dirt Work is the book, and Education in the Woods. Thanks to Dave Waldron, Josh Edge. I'm Steve Heimel. Thanks for listening.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922, on the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. And by Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, publishing statewide news on Alaska's business sector, government, and industry since 1985. Information and subscriptions online at akbizmag.com. Start a second career. Earn a Master's of Arts and Teaching degree from the University of Alaska Southeast, from home or on campus. Registration information at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.